From meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news, broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at scaredmonkeysradio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, we have a busy night ahead of us. Welcome, everyone, to Scared Monkeys Radio and the Dana Pretzer Show. Robin Sachs is here. You know her as a NBC legal analyst, a former felony prosecutor, and author, victims advocate. And Glendine Grant is here. And we haven't had Glendine on the show for a little bit, but she's very active. She has never given up hope that her daughter is still alive. The Kamloops, BC mother hasn't seen her daughter, Jessie Foster, since Christmas 2005. When the then 21-year-old came home for the holidays, Jessie had been living in Las Vegas and told her mom that she'd become engaged to be married. Glendine said, "We thought Jessie was living a normal life in Las Vegas, but ultimately that's not what was going on at all." And we're going to wonder and talk about tonight human trafficking with both Glendine and Robin and see, is Jessie Foster a victim of human trafficking? I want to start real quick with Robin Sachs, who's just making the rounds of the cable news shows, Nancy Grace and Jane Velez Mitchell. And I want to get a quick update with you, Robin, about John Mark Carr.
John Mark Carr is still evading us right now as we speak, although I'm confident that we're getting closer and closer to him. And I am also confident that he, the publicity, starting with your show, Dana, so super kudos to you because you hit it well before Nancy Grace and Jane Velez Mitchell and everybody else several weeks back. And we know that he has downloaded the show and listened as you thought he would. And hopefully... now with the now national coverage, we'll have more eyes and ears looking for him, and hopefully we will have him under service of subpoena and be available for the police interview that the investigators in San Francisco are seeking to do.
Hopefully, that would be good news. And yeah, I figured he'd listen to the show. He doesn't care for me much, but he likes to listen to the program. Glendine Grant, again, looking for her daughter, Jessie Foster, who's got a birthday coming up. It is so sad to talk about these stories. We've had you on the show before, Glendine. What's going on with the investigation to find Jessie?
Well, first, thanks again for having me, Dana. I always appreciate it. And, well, the investigation just seems to hover right around... between not too much, and there's always a trickle of something. I mean, I get phone calls from people who tell me that they've left messages with the North Las Vegas police, and unfortunately, they contact me because the police haven't always responded to them, and a few of the tips have actually been, in my opinion anyways, and our private investigators, pretty important to just not call them back. So we have to, besides keeping on... you know, keeping Jessie's case in everybody's eye, I also have to make sure that the police don't neglect anything. What I have taken to is sending everything I get in a carbon copy to four, to Crime Stoppers in Las Vegas and Kamloops, mm-hmm. and to the RCMP in Kamloops in North Las Vegas. So when I'm asking the North Las Vegas police officer direct questions and I don't get responses, then I reply to all four again asking why I'm not. And then I also take into reply, you know, just sending those same messages directly to the chief. Because I just think for something that has been going on for so long and people still interested in it and still calling in. I mean, I got a call just in August of last year. A man saw Young, Beautiful, and Vanished, that E! Entertainment documentary.
Mm-hmm.
And it caught his ear because they were talking about Las Vegas 2006, and he happened to have been there. And so he watched it, and his mouth dropped open because he recognized Jessie. Well, this was after Jessie went missing. They were talking about, I shouldn't have said they were talking about August of 2006, but they're talking about Jessie going missing in 2006 and him having been there in August, and he remembered Jessie, and he called the police. And, called me and said, "I'm going in for surgery." I don't even know if I'm going to come out of it. And I just can't believe the police didn't call me back, so I needed to leave a message with someone else. So it's pretty ironic, you know, how, you know, things can still be going on in the case, but really sometimes the police just don't even bother. I don't even understand why. For everything that's been going on, for how much work everyone else is putting into it, you would think that they would be grateful for every little bit they get that has landed basically on their lap.
Well, I want to ask Robin Glendine about just that, because she's been working with families. And, of course, you have talked to her, too, about cases just like this, whether it's human trafficking or just a simple disappearance or homicide or whatever, where sometimes people just aren't happy with the police response. They wait and wait and wait, and they just don't get it. Robin, your thoughts?
Well, it's unfortunately a record that plays, or you probably don't even, well, you remember what records are, but maybe your less listeners don't. It's the DVD or CD that just does not stop playing in my head. Why aren't the authorities interested in the case, or in this case, or doing anything about it? And human trafficking is even more difficult to get interest from law enforcement than any other area, I think, because it's something that we've had a problem with starting right from the beginning with the very words human trafficking.
Yeah.
We have a problem with terminology. I mean, the minute you say, oh, I think this could be a human trafficking case, you know, they're like, this isn't about someone being sent to Thailand or Cambodia. And you're like, no. Human trafficking, you know, selling people into servitude, you know, prostitution, sex trade, you know, labor trade, services trade, and that kind of thing. And they're like, oh, yeah. Well, that's a federal crime. Well, no, actually, it's a state crime, and it's also in terms of the way we deal with it. Very often, the victims are re-victimized throughout the system and are treated like perpetrators. Children are treated like prostitutes when children cannot, by definition, be prostitutes. They can be prostituted, they can be sold, but they cannot be prostitutes. So what does the cop do in a situation where you see a kid with a man and him paying for service? Well, you arrest the kid for prostitution because that's the nice and easy charge. And then the guy who's using the service say, well, oh, I thought she was older and I thought she was doing a favor, and he gets to walk. Well, that person who's buying that child is participating in human trafficking, whether they like it or not.
You know,
whether they know it or not, because if there was no demand, then there wouldn't be no need to supply. So even
correct.
If he doesn't believe that he is involved in human trafficking, just using the services is, you know, supplying the need. And that's something that people need to stop and think about. You know, and, you know, another thing, too, is when an adult prostitute gets arrested, I look at it in such a, it's so sad because now she's going to jail, she's getting charged, she's going to court. And then when she finally gets released and goes back to her pimp, she gets beat up because she had the nerve to go and get arrested.
Right.
So, you know, anytime somebody's doing anything, and I don't even care what the work is, if you're not getting paid, if you're not getting paid enough, if you don't get to keep your money, if you can't quit, if you can't leave, if you get beat because you don't do a good enough job, then those are not jobs in any way, shape, or form. That's human trafficking. And people have to realize that, you know, it's happening everywhere, and people, like Robin said, look at them as a different form. Oh, that child's not a human trafficking victim, they're prostitutes, so let's arrest them. Well, why not just think, why is a child finding the streets safer than their home? That's my number one question. Or any woman who is a prostitute, it had to start somewhere. Some perfectly good children get lured, some perfectly good women. But when you're talking about the prostitutes walking the street, the drug addicts that are feeding their drug habits, there is a problem with that because that started somewhere. You know, and that's a whole different topic. That's not the luring and the recruiting and the then forcing women into, you know, the situation. That's, you know, a whole different scenario. Unfortunately, there's a lot of that going on. There's a very famous serial killer named Robert Picton who,
yep,
he had a pig farm and he recruited, you know, prostitutes from one of the, it's called the lowest postal code income in Canada, and it's downtown Eastside, Vancouver. And, you know, those women got completely neglected in the eyes of the courts and the judges and the police and the public, because they figured that they chose their lifestyle and that's their problem. Now they're paying the price. I don't even know how someone can't wonder how a girl ended up like that. They didn't play their Barbies. They didn't say, I'm going to grow up to be a stoned-out hooker. In that situation,
I... If I could interrupt, Lizzie, I mean, there's one thing also happens. If a police officer arrests a victim of human trafficking, a child victim of human trafficking, and calls her and arrests her for prostitution, and she's convicted, well, she is called a prostitute. And that label then follows them forever on when they report crimes. So say that same child reports domestic battery by her husband 20 years later and is not being trafficked or not a victim of sexual assault or whatever, she will be forever marred with that label child prostitute. So that is at the beginning of where the problem is. We put these labels, we put this terminology, and these are the kids who are not just our runaways who become victims, but they're the people our society has decided are the throwaways.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, you're right. Glendine Grant and Robin Sachs are here. We're talking about human trafficking and the disappearance of Glendine's daughter, Jessie Foster, and there's a link in the show notes to learn more about Jessie's disappearance. Robin, I'll ask you to continue on a little bit and talk about education. And we've talked about it, you and I and other guests on this program now for a number of years about human trafficking, how the people, I call them Joe and Mary Sixpack, they just don't understand that term. And like you say, human trafficking, you're thinking of a big barge pulling into a port somewhere and opening it up, and there's 500 Cambodians or a van full of Mexicans coming through the border or something. They just don't understand the term. And besides this program and some others and a couple of cable news shows, Jane Velez Mitchell in particular, there's not a lot of education out there for human trafficking. Why?
Yeah, that's the problem. Well, first of all, probably the reason there's not a lot of education is because people don't know what it is. So let's just stay away from that weird topic of human trafficking and not talk about it, because we don't really know exactly what it is. The legal definition is different than the connotation of the word, but really it needs to be trained. The terminology, and there's been an effort in this professional world and the advocacy world to change over and stop calling it human trafficking and calling it modern day slavery, which is what it is. And it's not just sex slavery, it's labor slavery as well. And any time, and I think Lynn's going to hit on this, is that any time a person is sold or a service is sold where they are not receiving the benefits or the full benefits, or someone keeps an unfair amount or there's something along those lines, it could be modern day slavery. And certainly by definition, if there is a sale of a child, or if there is a child that's purchased for a sex act, by definition, that is human trafficking. The only thing, the earmark of trafficking is the exchange of money. So if there's money being exchanged, that's what it is. Now what we need to do as a society is learn about it. Now the problem is that if you go out there, there are, hundreds right now of fabulous documentaries. I've been part of one called The Playground Project, which the Nest Foundation has done. There's some other great ones out there that have been done. The problem is no major producers are willing to put their, and no major networks are willing to put this out there for popular consumption. I mean, the reason why, sexual assault gets noticed when the movie Precious comes out. But until human and then of course you do have Taken and some other great movies that have come about, in the last years about, being taken and trafficking. But of course all of the memorable movies are about cases that don't happen here in the United States. So it furthers the myth that it's an out of country problem. But what people need to understand is that the United States is the number one consumer of trafficked goods and people. It's our citizens that use the trafficked goods and services, and we are the number one the number two destination for people who want to buy trafficked goods. So if you want to buy a kid, you come here.
Wow.
And, you know, Jesse, we're from Canada. Jesse was taken down to the United States, so there's another perfect example.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have to come from Thailand or from Mexico. Jesse was taken from Canada down to Las Vegas. Well, first she was taken to other cities, but that's where she ended up. And, you know, and it's proof positive, but it certainly doesn't just exist there. I mean, there are so many human trafficking organizations that have started up in Canada. You know, there's Walk With Me, there's Canada Fights Human Trafficking, and, you know, Joy Smith has her, she's an MP, she's got her bill that's going to the Senate this week, hopefully to get passed, and that's to get some mandatory minimum sentencing here in Canada for human trafficking, people convicted of human trafficking of children. And, you know, so things are really starting to take notice. When Jesse first went missing and I said, you know, my goodness, I don't even know what, it wasn't even called human trafficking in my own mind. It's just Jesse was taken against her will somewhere that we don't know. And, you know, people finally, when I realized human trafficking, all they would say is I watch too much TV that have happened in third world countries. And now all I hear are, people, have you seen Taken? Have you seen human trafficking? I've just read stories and people are sending me links constantly to different organizations that are popping up. And I'm actually, I'm starting my own, and I know right now it's still mostly talk, but I'm getting a lot of people interested. But it's called MATH, M-A-T-H, Mothers Against Trafficked Humans, Against Trafficking Humans. See, I can't even get my name straight yet because it's so new. And the way I came up with it, besides MATH as the letters, I mean, do the math. When there's 26 billion people, I'm still getting my numbers wrong. I'm sorry, Dana. 26 million people a year, and $43 billion a year made off of trafficking in humans, then there's a lot of math to be done.
Yeah.
And we just need to make people aware of it. We need to have places for the victims to go. There's several organizations in Western Canada, in, you know, Midwestern Canada, in around Ottawa and Toronto. We have nothing out here. Kamloops doesn't have any place. Vancouver has the Office to Combat Trafficking, but that's by, you know, set up by the government, and that's not where victims are taken when they're rescued and given places to live and counseling to get through what's happened. And those are the things that are needed, because not everybody can get to Ontario if they happen to be, you know, saved in British Columbia or even, you know, Alberta somewhere. So there's more and more organizations opening up. And here's an ironic thing, too. There's an organization in Alberta called ACT, A-C-T, and it's the Action Coalition Against Human Trafficking. And it's one of the first organizations that I came across in Canada. And they actually referred a family to me last month whose daughter is a victim, which really led me to understand that even though this is an organization and it's well-known, and they've got a lot of people who are very well educated, they're not as knowledgeable as far as what they're going to do now when they have victims turn to them, because that's new. The victims are only now starting to show themselves. People are being saved when people are being arrested, and their victims are being, you know, saved, and they're right now not victims. They're now survivors. But where do they go? And this woman contacted me and said that she was referred to me, and that's when I really knew something more than just Jesse's mom has to be started here, and I really think that this is going to help a lot of people.
Glenn's making an excellent point also, or she doesn't realize she's making an excellent point. Part of the point and part of the issue is that part of the frustration in terms of law enforcement and social services and the people who have the resources to help trafficking victims is that they're not necessarily the most likable group of victims at times.
Right.
Sometimes get caught into this web where they think they want to be with their abuser. They constantly go back to their abuser. They're getting, you know, drugs and they're strung out from them and they don't kind of know how to help themselves. And so it takes a lot of intervention, a lot of specialty. This isn't someone that you can kind of just deal with in a quick, you know, let's throw it at a shrink type of thing. This is someone who's probably, you know, has been groomed, has been brainwashed potentially, has been, you know, addicted to drugs possibly, has gotten used to, you know, has got so many potential different crimes being committed against them, that they don't know which way that they're coming from, and probably and may have come from other abusive situations, only to think that this is their abuser, this new abuser is the only one who likes them and cares for them.
Right. Yeah, Glendine, I'm going to give you the last word. Tell the folks more where they can learn about the disappearance of your daughter and how they can help.
Well, jessiefoster.ca is our website, and just Googling her name, you can find a lot of information. And they can help just by passing Jessie's name around. We're always willing to take donations to our fund. We've got a reward fund, which is our reward is up to $50,000. We also, once our organization gets started, of course, we're going to need money. So anyone wants to hear about math, they can start donating. And just to let you know, one other thing, that I am working with Crime Stoppers now, and I've helped develop an educational program that we take into high schools. So we are starting to educate people. We're starting with young, you know, when they're in high school, that's when they become the most vulnerable. And Jessie actually met the person that took her to the United States while she was still in high school. So it's a very good point to get across, is that they need to learn. And, of course, the kids take a lot of the stuff home, and the parents learn things from the kids, from what they've learned at school. So I'm really quite happy with that program that we've got. We've got another two more schools booked for the first week in June. So, and then after that, we'll start up again in September. But I'm really happy to help anybody find out any information they need. They can just look us up on, you know, we're out there on the internet. Jessie's story is everywhere.
Yep.
And we just want to help, and we just want anyone to help us that can.
For sure. And keep up.
She's been missing 4 years, but this is her fifth birthday since she's been gone, because she went missing a couple months before her 22nd birthday. And I just want to find her. You know, yep. I want her to celebrate her next birthday, her champagne birthday, at home with us.
Absolutely.
I want her, you know, if we can't find her before Thursday, we need to find her right after.
Absolutely. And I wish you all the luck, Glendine. Please stay in touch. And Robin, keep up the good work. We'll talk soon.
Thank you so much.
Bye, Daniel. Bye, Glendine. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Robin. Bye.
That's Glendine Grant and Robin Sachs talking about human trafficking and the disappearance of Jessie Foster. Is she a victim of human trafficking? I don't know. We'll have to see where that goes, and we hope for the best for Glendine and her family. And we hope Robin and those looking for John Mark Carr can find him. I'm Dana Pretzer. We're going to take a quick break, and we're going to come back with someone else who's looking for a missing loved one. Drew Kessie will be here to talk about his missing daughter, Jennifer. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back. This is the Dana Pretzer Show here on Scared Monkeys Radio. My next guest I've had on with me many times, talking about the disappearance of his daughter. He sent me a note the other day saying that Jennifer Kessie turned 29 here recently, and I thought I'd bring Drew Kessie on to talk about the disappearance of his daughter. Always an interview where I want you to have some, I hate that term closure, Drew, but some answers, I guess. Am I wrong when I say I don't like that term closure?
No, you're not wrong. No, I don't think they ever have closure, but answers would be great.
You know, I just, because how do you go through this? Here's your, again, I'm looking at her picture right now. Click on the show notes link to learn more about Jennifer's disappearance. Beautiful young girl, life ahead of her, just turned 29. Yeah, to you and I, my friend, that's a baby. I wished I was 29 again. But here we're talking about your daughter who's missing. Hopefully the investigation is still going ahead. Have you learned anything recently?
Well, unfortunately, I guess about a month ago, we met with Orlando Police Department, and they had gone through 1,100 leads and come to the conclusion that they're pretty much done what they can do for Jennifer.
Hmm.
It was very saddening, be quite honest with you, and their plan of action is to wait for the next viable lead to come in. That's just very disheartening. You know, she's out there somewhere.
And
as I've always said, it gets difficult every day, and it really does get more difficult every day.
I believe it. I believe it, because you want to. I remember Dave Holloway telling me that he'd move heaven and earth to find his daughter Natalie. And I've heard other parents tell me the same thing. I just had Glendine Grant on, who you know, and to see these sorts of cases without answers is so heartbreaking. But yet the strength of your family and others, and I use you as an example many times about how you turn your tragedy, your family's tragedy around to help others is excellent. And, it's very heartwarming to see, Drew. Another thing I brought you on tonight to talk about is the Catch Me Killer trial. And, we've talked about that before on the show. Introduce that to my audience. What are we talking about?
We had a gentleman who introduced himself on YouTube as the Catch Me Killer, who had killed 16 young women and had 17th in hand, and he would give clues as to each one as he went through his list, and at the end, and he would know who he was and kill the 17th. The first one was right out of the box, Tara Grinstead from Georgia, which Jennifer and Tara had a show on a major network together one night. And he actually posted on one of Jennifer's YouTubes that maybe I could help you under Catch Me Killer, and I clicked on it, and up comes this video of a blurred face that says that I've killed 16 and blah, 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 blah.
Right.
And I immediately knew it was Tara. So I said, well, okay, you know, let's see if Jennifer's in there. And it's very scary. I have to be honest with you, it was a very serious video to me. And to go through the trial, it was a serious video. And it's really the first time I've ever testified, first time I've ever been in a courtroom in my life. And it can't fathom what the young man was thinking, honestly.
Yeah, you know, and I'm beyond words because I'm familiar with the case, and you're right. You can't fathom what they're thinking. And when we look at some of my guests call it social networking, Drew, the Facebooks and the MySpaces and YouTubes and other things like this, which gives a platform, if you may, to many who are looking for a voice like your family and others where maybe some good could come out of it, but it also gives that platform to, well, the crazies that are out there to bring a lot of heartache and a lot of false hope, and that's my term, to families like yours. Are we able to draw the line, or is it just something that we have to live with today's technology?
Well, I think especially with today's technology, in fact, we just changed the threat laws in Florida this year to include electronic devices. Believe it or not, the only way in Florida that you can get brought to court for threatening someone's life is if you do it verbally in front of someone else, or if you write it on a piece of paper until October 10th of this year.
Yeah.
Now it will include electronic devices. It's moving too fast for us. You know, the laws have to catch up. But it's not like, you know, there's a difference. I mean, you know, the web is the wild, wild west and all that good stuff. But, you know, it is a double-edged sword. And my true feeling is you cannot go out there and actually come out and say, I want to confess
right.
that I killed 16 people and give clues to families of missing people and expect not to have repercussions. That is just, I'm sorry, that goes beyond normal thought, that goes beyond normal behavior
yeah.
in our society as we know it, I feel.
Oh, I couldn't agree more.
You know, there is a point, and you know, the internet sooner or later has to catch up to the laws of the land. It's not just going to stay wild forever. It can't.
No, I can't. That's for sure. Drew Kessie is here. We're talking about the disappearance of his daughter, Jennifer, and the Catch Me Killer trial. Was there a disposition at the end of the trial, Drew?
I'm sorry. A judgment, you mean?
Right.
Yes, there was.
And again, just because I'm getting a couple emails here, and if you have already gone over that, go over that one more time for me, please.
Andrew Haley is his name, was convicted of two counts of felony, one for tampering with evidence and one for false statements. And basically got the sentences 1 to 10 years. He did get 10 years on both counts, but he was the first offender, so got knocked down to 3 years. He is going to be out on work release, so he has to work 2 years on work release, and then he has 10 years probation. If he breaks any probation, he goes to jail for at least 20 years or more.
And certainly no internet connections for him.
No, in fact, it's you know, the state of Georgia, which he was tried in, it's amazing because the gentleman will have to pay for all of his services, be it probation, be it drug testing, be it mental analysis, everything from soup to nuts he will pay for, which I think is very proactive in law enforcement.
Right, and excellent. But again, it doesn't bring Jennifer back.
No, Dan, if I may interrupt you,
sure.
that's the saddest part is,
yeah.
It's almost melancholy. It's like, it has nothing to do with Jennifer. It's just, you have to bring in the reins of social society, but.
Exactly.
It had nothing to do with Jennifer, and it's just such a shame that to this day, they are no closer than day two of when Jennifer was taken, and that is probably the most disheartening.
It's false. It's false hope, and families should not have to go through false hope the way that they have been. Drew, I'm going to let you go here in a minute because I got an email message from Joe Ocasio that I'd like to read in a minute or two. And all the families that I talk with on the program, you know my heart and my listeners' hearts are with you, and hopefully someday there will be answers for you, Drew. And again, anything that I can do to help, I will certainly try my best. And I thank you for coming on, sir.
We do thank you, Dana, and we do feel that. And thank you so much, and have a good evening.
We'll have you on again soon.
Okay. To Joe and Liz Cassidy. I'll catch you next time, please.
I will. Okay, bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
Okay, that's Drew Kessie, and it's so sad, I tell you. And here we go again. We just talked about Jesse Foster. We just talked about Jennifer Kessie. This comes from Joe Ocasio. Joe Ocasio's daughter, Tracy, is missing. Go to Tracy Ocasio. Ocasio is spelled OCASIO.com. So Tracy, TRACY, Ocasio, OCASIO.com. It's incredible that tomorrow, and we're talking about the 26th of May, will be 1 year since Tracy was taken from us. It seems like yesterday, the same pain, the same sickening feeling, the same anger and frustration. We continue to get questions if we are having a vigil tomorrow in her name, but at this point, it will only bring more pain and suffering to our family. Maybe someday. Rather than mourning at this point, we choose to continue to put our energy and efforts into trying to find her. Some people say this has become an obsession. However, she is our firstborn and only daughter. It is the only hope we have, and it is hope that what keeps us going. It says, on Saturday, June 5th and Sunday, June 6th, we're going to continue our efforts to find her. The group search and rescue of Central Florida is going to continue to help us with the search teams around the outside of the state. And it's just heartbreaking to see these stories, and I've just mentioned three in the last 40 minutes. There are many, many, many more out there. So if you can do anything on the internet, sit down and Google missing persons. Go to the Scared Monkeys forum, the missing persons site, and look at all the names there. Look at the web pages. And for heaven's sakes, if you know anything about these cases, call. Call Crime Stoppers. Call someone. Get some information out there. I sat down earlier today with Mike McIntyre, the syndicated radio host. He has an excellent show called Crime and Punishment. He's also a crime reporter for the Winnipeg Free Press and an author of 4 true crime books to talk about a very interesting case that's going on not too far from where I live. Here's Mike. Okay, we're back. You'll know my next guest, Mike McIntyre, is a justice reporter with the Winnipeg Free Press, host of the wildly successful Crime and Punishment radio show on the Chorus and Rocco radio networks. He's an author of 4 Canadian true crime books. And, of course, you can check out his website at www.mikeoncrime.com. Hi, Mike. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, always good to be here.
Interesting story, actually more than interesting, going on, actually partially involving a jurisdiction not too far from where I am, so I have to be careful what I say. But I want to go along the lines of the media and how the media either helps or hinders cases like this. And in particular, I'm talking about the LaFortune alleged torture case. If you could give my audience a little kind of their mini Reader's Digest version. Remember the mini Reader's Digest used to come?
Yes, I do indeed.
About what's going on.
Yeah, this is something right out of a mob movie, potentially. Basically got a guy who is in his mid-20s, healthy, big guy, 250-plus pounds, has been living in Winnipeg, Manitoba, central Canada. He's more or less recruited to move a couple provinces over to Alberta to go live and work in Calgary for, I guess, a friend of his, a guy who owns some kind of trucking business in Calgary. He moves west and goes to work for this man. In fact, he begins living with his boss, his friend, and according to family, everything seems just fine for the first few months. But then they start to detect that something has changed. In phone conversations and text messages, they get a sense that something is just a little off about all this. And the concerns really pick up earlier this year when the young man in question here, Dustin LaFortune, more or less vanishes from civilization. Nobody's hearing from him. His phone line's been disconnected. He's not returning text messages. And this is very much unlike him. He's actually got a young child back in Winnipeg still that he'd often come to visit and certainly stay in touch with. That sort of all goes by the wayside, and now there's great concern about what's going on here. The roommate slash boss has also disappeared at this point, and it appears that the trucking company that he's been working for doesn't even exist anymore. So lots of mysterious circumstances that really come to a head about a month ago when Dustin LaFortune, the man now who hasn't been heard from for some time, suddenly gets dropped off at a hospital in Regina. And for listeners not familiar with the geography of Canada, Regina is about the midway point between Winnipeg and Calgary. This is now in the province of Saskatchewan, as you say, Dana, not too far from where you are. He's dumped at the hospital by a man who claims to be his cousin, mm-hmm. gives a name of a cousin who actually is a legitimate person. The thing is, this is not his cousin who drops him off. The family believes this is the roommate slash boss who dumps him, and Dustin LaFortune is an absolute mess. He's in hospital. He shows signs of torture. And perhaps the squeamish here may want to turn their volume down for a second, because the injuries include his tongue has been cut, his lips have been cut off, he's been burned, and the 250-pound man has now been reduced to about a 90-pound man, showing signs of extreme starvation. And perhaps most alarming of all injuries is there's brain damage. They still are not sure to what extent the brain damage is and how permanent and how disabling it will be, but certainly signs of brain damage, signs of repeated beatings. This was not a one-time incident. This appears to have gone on for quite some time. And now, Dana, many, many questions. Dustin LaFortune is still in hospital. In fact, he's probably going to be in hospital for months and faces a long road of rehabilitation. And again, how promising his future looks is a big question mark. But so many questions. Who did this? Why did they do this? Yep. why did they dump him at the hospital? You know, what happened to this man? And it's very much a mystery that has consumed, I think, Canadians. And in fact, this story has gone viral, as you will, and is being read, I think, by folks all over the world.
You know, and you say it best, Mike McIntyre is here, when you compare it to, you know, like a mob movie. Here you got a guy, and probably his size originally is what kept him alive today, because someone at 90 or 110 pounds, and to go through what he's allegedly gone through, well, he's not allegedly, obviously he went through it, and to be tossed out like a bag of garbage in front of a hospital is bizarre, to say the least. Now, I don't want to talk too much about the investigation, because, again, I'm not too far away from that jurisdiction, but I'm going to fast forward, if you may. The family, obviously, wondering what's going on, did like many families do in cases like this. They come to the media and ask for help, and I'll let you go from there.
Yeah, it's actually, this story is a fascinating example of, I guess, modern day police work to a degree, and yeah, and modern day pleas for help, because this whole case came to light largely because of the internet and through social networking sites like Facebook. Just to give you a little bit of background, again, to round out the picture, this was mid-April that this young man turned up in hospital. The family found out about it, of course, and were very concerned about what had happened. This was all a mystery to the police. They knew who this man was, but they had no idea what happened to him. They did not make any arrests at the time, and in fact, whatever investigation was going on in those first few weeks was kept completely quiet. There was no news conference or media release talking about what had happened to him. The family wasn't happy with this. They felt that the police weren't taking them seriously, weren't taking the case seriously. So they went to the internet, which is what a lot of folks do these days. They created Facebook groups, and I think what really pushed this over the edge and certainly got the attention of the media and therefore the public was when they posted pictures. The most dramatic pictures, the most graphic pictures taken of Dustin LaFortune as he lay in hospital, brain damaged and apparently tortured, they posted those pictures on the internet. And in fact, they posted them side by side with pictures of a very healthy Dustin LaFortune. You couldn't help but be captivated by what you were seeing, and it wasn't long before media quickly picked up on this story. Who is Dustin LaFortune? What exactly is going on here? Well, it spread like wildfire, and pretty soon stories were being done coast to coast on this, and suddenly the police were now in a position where whatever investigation was going on very quietly was now way out in the open. Mm-hmm. They were getting bombarded with questions and, to some degree, I guess, demands for answers and for a quick resolution.
Well, you know, in a case like this, and I'm not going to generalize this case in particular, but any case, the big high-profile cases, and we don't see a lot of it here in Saskatchewan or even, you know, somewhat in Canada. You could probably, I'm sure you cover the cases, can count on all your fingers and toes the amount of really high-profile cases in the last 5 or 6 years that have got the social networking involved as much as they have now, Mike. But all of a sudden, the media comes, or the family comes to the media start doing what they do, and now I'm hearing the family has said to the media, no, stop, we don't want your help anymore.
Yeah, it's been an interesting 180 from the family. I suppose they maybe hit the point of feeling like it was just becoming overwhelming. I suspect, I don't know this for sure, but maybe the police have talked to the family and said, look, you're not helping here. This is not making our job any easier. And in fact, you know, some family members went so far because they strongly suspect they know who did this.
Right.
They believe it was this roommate slash boss slash friend. They don't know why this man would have done this. They don't know what message this was supposed to send or what the motive here was, but they believe that he's responsible. And they've actually gone so far as to create wanted posters, which they were putting online.
Yeah.
Not only, of course, could that hinder the police investigation and their attempts to maybe find this man and talk to him, there's also legal issues which could potentially come up down the road. Let's say this person hasn't done anything, and all of a sudden his name has been linked to this, and he's more or less being convicted before he's even been charged. So a lot of interesting issues at play here, and maybe the family's been told to sort of tone it down. I mean, clearly the police have this in their hands. You know, maybe people aren't happy with the pace of the investigation and the answers that haven't come yet, but there's no doubt the police are taking it seriously and are looking into this. And I guess the family's initial intentions to draw some attention to all this case have been more than successful, and now is maybe the time to just take that step back, let the police do their job, and let the justice system do its job, and sort of see where everything falls out.
Well, exactly, and that's why you're such a good radio host, because you just took my next question to you, is maybe it is time that the police are allowed to do what they want to do, but you really can't blame the cops in this case, the Regina police, saying, you know, we always want tips. But slow down on the Facebook stuff a little bit. But then again, you can't blame the media either for taking the story and running with it, because, like I say, we don't see many like this.
Well, and you know, just look at the you know, nowadays, of course, in the media, we can instantly track how popular a story is. I think that's a big driving force behind a lot of the decisions that get made. You talk about newspaper websites, for instance, WinnipegFreePress.com. We've had the story all over our website, and our volume of hits on these stories is through the roof. They're constantly the most viewed, most commented, most emailed stories out there. Clearly, the public is fascinated with this story, and you're right. I think from a media perspective, I mean, this has now been kind of handed to us on a platter. All the parties, you had the family very willing to talk. You had the pictures, which tell 1,000 words or more, perhaps, in this case. And it was a no-brainer to proceed with it. But perhaps all of us sort of got caught up in it, and now we're kind of all standing around saying, okay, now what's next? You know, maybe we'd like the police to be a little more forthcoming, but obviously they have a job to do, and their job isn't to answer to us. It's obviously to answer to the citizens of this country, and to protect citizens and to do their job. And one would suspect they know how to best go about doing that right now. And as you mentioned, they have asked for tips, so in a way they are including the public. But they haven't had that big news conference yet to kind of explain what this is all about. I think we'd all like more answers than we have at this point, but sometimes you have to be patient.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, short of putting Charles Adler in a Nancy Grace lookalike wig, besides you, there in this area, there really isn't any crime reporting type of media, so to speak. Of course, we have, you know, news talk radio stations that will cover the story.
Sure, but you're right. In a way, I mean, I think Canadian police agencies probably haven't seen anything along the lines of what their, you know, compatriots to the south are often seeing. When you talk about the Nancy Graces of the world that are on these stories 24/7, that are examining every lead, every angle of the story, no matter how ridiculous, no matter how trivial or not, really putting these cases and, by extension, the investigators under a microscope. We don't get that to that degree in Canada, and perhaps a case like this is as close as we'll ever get to it, but I don't think we'll ever see that sort of news machine, that tabloid news machine like we see in the U.S. Crank itself up here in Canada. But it is interesting with websites like Facebook how these stories can take on a life of their own, and one always has to be very careful, because, as I say, there are legal issues here. And sometimes you know, what might be seen as helping an investigation could actually be doing the very opposite.
Well, police agencies you know, rely on Crime Stoppers lines and tip lines, but again, I think there's an educational aspect here too, that maybe the media, and I know at the Canadian Police College and here in Saskatchewan, there are media relations courses about how to sit back and work a scrum, for example, or to do a press release, but to actually sit back and have reporters and cops in the same room and saying, here's what we do, here's what you do, how can we work together to get the same common goal here is something that might need to be looked at. Anyway, Mike McIntyre is here. He hosts a popular crime and punishment radio show on Sunday nights on the Chorus and Rolco radio networks and is a crime reporter with the Winnipeg Free Press. It will be interesting to see where this story goes. What's coming up with the show on Sunday, Mike?
This Sunday, geez, Danny, you've caught me a little off guard because we're only we're early in the week here and usually don't prepare that far in advance. I'm not nearly as well prepared as you are with my show schedule, but Judge Ray Wyant will be along this weekend. He does something that very few judges in Canada do. I know in the U.S., judges are often, well, they are accountable to the public because they're elected, of course. In Canada, they're not. And they're really under no obligation in Canada to speak to the public, to justify anything they do. But Judge Ray Wyant is kind of cut from a different cloth. He used to be the chief judge in Manitoba, where I work out of. His term is now up as chief judge, but he joins us every month and, as I say, does something very few judges do in this country and what I suspect many would be afraid to do in this country, which is take cold calls from listeners about legal and justice issues. So always a popular segment. And another segment we've been doing lately that I have a ton of fun doing, we try and find one every week to do. We call it You Be the Jury, where we take an issue or a case that's of some controversy and maybe not so clear cut, and we kind of examine the facts of it, and then I throw it out, and we get 12 callers, 12 being the number on a jury, to sort of render our verdict, and then we compare it to what the actual verdict was. It's been very interesting. Not only does it sort of show how the jury system works, but it also shows how difficult it can be to get 12 people to agree on anything. I've often said that I could state the sky is blue, and you would probably have trouble getting 12 people to agree on that, and this little experiment we do is always evidence of that. So we'll probably have another good You Be the Jury issue to examine on the weekend as well.
Well, sounds great. I've heard both segments before, and they're very interesting, very popular. I still think it would be a great idea to put a blonde wig on Adler. Get him to shave, though. And
I'll make sure he gets on that.
So. Yeah, and he could be the Nancy Grace of the North.
Absolutely.
Mike McIntyre, thank you, sir.
Thank you. Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
That's Mike McIntyre from the Crime and Punishment radio show and a regular guest here on the program. This is the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be right back. And we are right back. One of my favorite talk radio stations, believe it or not, even where I live, is 850, the big blowtorch out of Denver, Colorado. And one of the hosts on that network is a fellow by the name of Michael Brown. Brownie. Does that sound familiar? Yeah, he was the guy that took all the flack after Hurricane Katrina. He was in charge of FEMA. He's a Washington insider, an attorney, and now a very competent talk radio host on 850 KOA. And I sat down with him to talk about immigration and the BP oil spill and all things political. Here's Mike Brown. All right, we're back. It's my pleasure tonight to have with us Michael D. Brown. If you listen to talk radio like I do, even up here where I live, KOA 850 in Denver is probably one of the strongest signals around. I've been following this gentleman's career, and I've been listening to his talk show for some time, and I'm quite honored to have him on the program tonight. Good evening, sir.
Good evening, Dana. Great to be here.
And nice to have you. Now, you are a Washington guy. You spent some time there. No stranger to attacks from the media, but we're not in this interview to talk about that. I wanted to bring you on to talk a little bit about your show because, like I say, KOA Denver, even up here in Saskatchewan, Canada comes in nice and strong, and I listen to your program quite a lot. How does a former director of FEMA get to host a talk show in Denver?
You know what's great about it is it's something I've always wanted to do, and a lot of my friends in D.C. and other places are very jealous of it, so I get a lot of satisfaction out of it. It's actually very, the whole story is very ironic. I did a media interview, of all things, with a TV host here in Denver, which is my hometown,
mm-hmm.
and that guy leaned over and said, you really ought to be on television or radio.
Yep.
And I just kind of laughed and said, well, you know, that'd be fine, but whatever. Well, lo and behold, he had a talk show on one of the Clear Channel stations, and he talked to the station manager and said, you've got to talk to this guy.
Mm-hmm.
So I started doing substitutions, and the next thing I know, they've offered me a full-time gig, and I'm doing it. And as you say, KOA is one of the original 50,000-watt blowtorch stations that the FCC gave those original licenses to way back in the 40s or 50s. And we cover 38 states, Canada, Mexico, plus everything on the Internet. So I'm not surprised that Saskatchewan gets me. It's great.
Well, I'm not sure if you know or not, but when I'm not doing the radio gig, I'm actually a full-time cop. And as I'm patrolling around in my police car between 7 and 10 on KOA, I'm listening to Michael Brown, and I get a big kick out of it. Anyway...
Well, thank you.
Yeah, what the reason I brought you on here, not only because I admire your work in radio and the work that you've done with the government, not only that, you're an attorney and you do lecturing, all sorts of things, but something that we covered here quite a bit on my program, right down to interviewing members of the Minutemen to congressmen to you name it, is immigration. And when we look at Arizona and we look at what's going on, especially with the Obama administration. Now, there's a big story out this morning about Sheriff Joe Arpaio, who I admire quite a bit, going after the Mexicans for putting this ad in the paper. I mean, you've probably seen it with the binoculars. We're looking for people from Arizona. This has just gone crazy, or am I wrong?
No, you're absolutely correct. You're absolutely correct. And I'm astounded at the, I don't know why I am, but I am truly astounded at the amount of misinformation and the amount of hyperbole and emotion that has gotten into this debate. I've always considered, even when I was the Undersecretary of Homeland Security with the Department of Homeland Security, I always maintained that immigration is a national security issue.
Yeah.
I mean, as you well know in Canada, we are concerned, North America at large, but particularly the United States and Canada, about who is here. And if we don't control our borders and know who is in our country, there's nothing to prevent an Al-Qaeda or Hezbollah or any other terrorist organization from infiltrating either one of our countries.
When we talk immigration, and we've done it before, when we talk about border security, the border guards, the Homeland Security people, you know this better than anyone. I can remember very plainly the two border agents, Compion and Ramos, shooting the Mexican drug dealer in their rear end, and they themselves going to jail. It was a huge, big disaster. A lot of people, we call them Joe and Mary Sixpack here on the program, sit back and they say, it really doesn't affect us. But when you look at the state of Arizona, Texas, California, others, obviously it does affect the people there, and the ripple effect does affect, you know, North America. I'll tell you a story about my own family and immigration and myself into the United States in a minute or two. But when you look at it, and from your perspective now as a talk show host, Michael, do most people really sit back and wonder, as we see in the media, about immigration and say, yes, we really care, or is that being overhyped a bit too?
That's a great question, Dana, and I have to say my gut tells me that the majority of Americans, once they start talking about it or reading it, they are concerned. Because I think most people see through the smoke screen of racism, they see through the smoke screen of, you know, it's very easy to feel sorry for some of the typical people that sneak into the country to actually just work and try to send money home and take care of their families. I understand the emotions of that. But I think when people look at it objectively and they're sitting in their homes reading a newspaper or listening to a talk show, suddenly they realize, holy cow, this really is a serious issue, not just in terms of national security, but what it is costing this country in terms of the social costs of, and I put social costs in two categories. One is the actual dollars that we have to spend taking care of these people. And the other social cost is the loss of our culture. Most immigrants to this country, and I think most immigrants to almost any country, assimilate to that nation. And most of the people coming to this country now, to the United States, don't assimilate. They bring their own culture, which is great. I have nothing, no problem with people celebrating their heritage and their culture of their ancestors.
Yeah.
But, you know, our motto in the United States is e pluribus unum, out of many one. And we're not requiring that assimilation anymore. And as I've said on my talk show and in speeches around the country, I truly believe that failure to assimilate immigrants into your country results in the Balkanization of the country. So that at some point we could be like the old Eastern European Soviet bloc countries where, you know, there is no Czechoslovakia anymore. It's broken down into these little nuggets of just ethnic regions. And that's wrong. That's, what made this country was we brought all of these immigrants from all around the world and created one country, and now we're going the other direction.
Yeah, that's for sure. If you're just tuning in, Michael Brown is here. You can hear his talk radio program, excellent talk radio program, on 850 KOA, Monday to Friday, 7 to 10 o'clock each evening. We're talking immigration with Michael. I'm 29 minutes away from the North Dakota border. In my 28 years of policing, I've investigated quite a few border jumps, we like to call them, where someone will come around the border because maybe they got a bottle of whiskey underneath their seat and they don't want to pay the duty on it, or for whatever reason they may have a traffic warrant or something. Really nothing that serious. But when you look at Homeland Security and you look at the border and how porous the border is, obviously on the Mexican side and even on the Canadian side, Michael, it makes you wonder. My personal experience, it's no secret that I've talked many times on this program, I've been doing this for 13 years now, how I would love to hang up my gun and my badge and do a talk radio program full time in the United States. But anyone I've ever talked to, they would say, Canadian? Oh, yeah, it's real tough to get a Canadian to legally come into the United States. It's huge. I have two daughters that live and go to school in North Dakota, and even to get a student visa for them was a huge problem. Now I have a daughter who's going to school in North Dakota. She and her significant other are expecting a child here in the end of August. I never thought I'd be a grandfather so young. just the issue of, you know, is it that simple that as soon as she has her baby in the States and she wants to, that baby becomes an American citizen, and then she becomes an American citizen? No, it's not that simple. And the health care issue for her is a huge problem, even though she's been living with her boyfriend for almost a year now. And it almost seems like if you want to come into the United States legally, and I gave you a couple of examples, even in my own family, it is such a headache, such a pain, that people sit back and they see what the Obama administration wants to do, and they just say, this isn't right. Why would we even want to come to the United States then?
And it's not right. And that's one of the frustrating things to me, is that our bureaucracy in Homeland Security, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Bureau, the Citizenship Bureau, all of those things have become so unwieldy that for those who are trying to do it correctly, it becomes this almost insurmountable roadblock to do. And so no one's trying to reach a happy medium, which really bothers me, because we should encourage immigration. And if, as some on the other side of the argument would maintain, that we need these immigrants to do these jobs and we need it for the economy, you know, et cetera, well, that's great. Then we should increase the numbers of visas available, and we should increase the number of immigration opportunities for people. But at the same time, we should increase the efficiency of processing those people so they can get here. It is almost like, and I think this is more true on the Canadian border than it is on the southern border, because on the southern border we just have people who are just, you know, sneaking across. Mm-hmm. But those Canadians who want to come here and work and pursue their professions and things, we make it incredibly hard for them.
Yep.
So either way, it seems like we're just screwing up the entire immigration process in this country.
Michael Brown is here, and we're talking immigration, and I'm going to get a quote from him here in a little bit, or a comment from him about the, and he probably knew I wouldn't let this one go, the BP oil spill. I'd be remiss to not ask him about that. But right now we're talking immigration, and when we look at coverage, again, I want to talk about the media and how they've been covering this this story next to Michael Brown on the radio. I'm a huge Bill O'Reilly fan, and watching O'Reilly last night do a segment on Arizona, and maybe you'll be talking about this on your program too, Michael, about how now they're screening English teachers whether or not they can speak proper English. Another story came up in Arizona about just what I talked about. There was a senator on O'Reilly last night, and his name is slipping my mind. Maybe you saw it, but you're doing your show right at that time too, where they don't want someone in their state who has a baby who is not a United States citizen having that baby, and just because they have it in Arizona doesn't necessarily mean it becomes a U.S. citizen. And that's what I love about O'Reilly. He went nuts on that one. Is Arizona shooting themselves in the foot a little bit when it comes to this? Because really the immigration law or the and I've read it. I've done what some higher-ups in the Obama administration haven't done.
Right.
It really isn't anything different than what they had before. In fact, there are some stringent guidelines that they do have to follow. But just because you're not from the United States and you have a baby in that country or in that state, they're saying that they may not recognize that. I'm not sure if they even have that power.
Well, to your point about Arizona, it is – sometimes people just aren't politically smart, and you should choose your battles wisely, and I think here they've taken on too much. They did the Senate Bill 1070, which is the legislation you and I were talking about. They should focus on that, get over that hurdle, and then if they have a problem with or a issue of English teachers that can't speak English or whatever, deal with that later.
Right.
But to throw all of this on at one time creates such a confusion that the push that you're making to create a fundamental problem will get lost in the minutiae of all the other stuff you're trying to correct at the same time. So as in any political situation, you should get on your message, you should get focused on that issue and stick to it. Because when you bring in all these other peripheral things, as you say, it gets mired down and then everybody gets confused, and it's very easy for Mary and Joe Sixpack, as you talk about.
Yeah.
It's very easy for them at that point to say, oh, this is a huge mess, and for them to turn it off and go to something else.
Let's talk about California. What we're hearing about everyone wanting to cancel contracts with Arizona. This is crazy. Sports teams not coming to compete in a tournament in Arizona. Yeah, what's that fueled by? Is that just political incorrectness? Is that media coverage run amok? Or is that just people thinking that they're honestly going to make a difference? We know that Arizona is not going to shut off California's power, and some of these contracts being canceled and all that. That's just nuts. Or, again, am I wrong?
No, I think you're absolutely right, and it is all about, it's media driven, because the mayors of San Francisco and Los Angeles and others they know they'll get the media attention if they call for a boycott. They're playing to their constituency in those two cities, which happen to be illegal aliens.
Yes, exactly.
So it becomes this self-fulfilling prophecy that if they get on the tube, they get on the radio, well, absolutely it's going to get coverage.
Yeah, and
the hypocrisy of it, Dana, is amazing, because California has a law similar to Arizona. And on my show last night, I was describing a situation in Boston where an illegal alien, a Mexican, rear-ended in a car accident a state representative in Boston, and they arrested this man. It was an ordinary stop, as best I could tell, from a car accident. You would say there's nothing unusual about it.
Right.
Well, it turns out this guy is an illegal alien, doesn't have a driver's license, registration, no insurance, nothing. Under the Mitt Romney, the previous governor, a Republican in Massachusetts, he signed an order that said in that case, in those kinds of situations, you can turn that person over to the immigration authorities for, you know, proceedings, deportation or whatever. The current governor, Deval Patrick, a Democrat, rescinded that order, and now the cops in Boston are sitting there. They have an illegal alien who has caused an accident, and they can do nothing about it.
If he was in New York, he'd spend a couple of days in Rikers. They'd let him go and then cut him a check for $150,000.
Bingo. Exactly right.
Oh, man, I'll tell you. Michael Brown is here again. You can listen to his wonderful talk show on KOA 850 Denver, 7 to 10 o'clock weeknights. I got to let my audience get a comment from you on this BP oil spill, how the government has responded to it. We're hearing everything. In fact, my commentary today or tomorrow, I forget which day it is now, talks about was the government slow, really, because BP is a big contributor to Barack Obama. I'm not sure. You had your feet held to the fire with Katrina, criticized for everything that you did and everything you didn't do. What's going on here? Is it fair what we're seeing about BP, or is the government actually sitting on their thumbs?
Well, unfortunately, I think there's three things going on. I think the government really is sitting on its thumbs, but they're sitting on their thumbs because they don't have the expertise. They don't have the ability to respond and do something. That's number one. The second point is, in 1994, President Clinton and his FEMA director, James Lee Witt, who's a good friend of mine, they're Democrats, I'm a Republican, but we get along great.
Mm-hmm.
They created a 1994 response plan specifically for oil spills on, lakes like you have in Saskatchewan or lakes like we have here or offshore like we have in the Gulf. They never funded the purchase of the equipment to do the containment. So I think when Janet Napolitano, the Secretary of Homeland Security, finally implemented that plan about 2 weeks after the oil spill, everybody looked around and went, holy cow, we don't have the stuff to do it with. So I think they're sitting on their thumbs. They're sitting on their thumbs because they know if they push or get too involved, people will start asking the question, why didn't you have the equipment? And that's the fault of both Republican and Democrat administrations. And my point about it is, it proves that at some point, our federal government has become very inept, very incapable of doing some very simple things, like just making sure you have the right equipment. And I think the third point that gets lost in the whole BP oil spill is there are 4,000 operating wells in the Gulf of Mexico right now. We have one accident, and people are just agaga over it. And I don't mean to diminish the problem that it's causing in the wetlands and the marshes and everything else. That will eventually get solved and eventually get cleaned up, but immediately it's a harm to those people, and it's an immediate harm to the environment. But people forget that BP America has an absolute vested interest in doing everything they can to shut that well down, because as long as that well is out of control, they're losing money, and as long as it's out of control, it's costing them money trying to fix it.
Exactly.
So they're not just, BP's not just sitting back saying, well, Shazam, look at this mess we've got here, and not doing anything. They are doing everything technically and engineeringly possible to fix that, because it's costing them and their shareholders bukus of dollars.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a pretty big ocean, according to Janet Napolitano.
I've got to go back and check my geography again.
And maybe they need to stop sitting on their thumbs and use their thumbs to block that oil leak. I don't know what
they're
going
to do. That's it, Dana.
Listen, Michael Brown, I appreciate this. Maybe we can do this again sometime.
Anytime. My pleasure.
Thank you, sir. Bye-bye. And you can listen to Michael Brown on KOA Denver weeknights, 7 to 10 o'clock. And, of course, you remember Michael Brown as director of FEMA during Hurricane Katrina, and he took a lot of flack over that one. And you listen to his talk show. It's a great talk show. He's a down-to-earth kind of guy, one who isn't afraid to speak his mind and say exactly what's going on in his mind with the government and others. I'm Dana Pritzer. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be right back. And that's it. That's tonight's show. I hope you enjoyed it. Thanks to all my guests. And I'd like to remind you that our webpage is www.scaredmonkeysradio.com. There you can listen to the show live. You can pick up podcasts of past shows. You can leave comments. You can do whatever you like there. Just make sure that it's legal and above board. I'm Dana Pritzer. I will see you again real soon here on Scared Monkeys Radio.
You've been listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guest websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.